Hello everybody, and welcome to a new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host, and this week in Reykjavik, I played, I guess, one of the biggest games of the last 10 years, which I guess means one of the biggest games ever, in anticipation of God of War Ragnarok, which is now out. I decided to go back into my half-finished save file from God of War 2018, and I decided to finish that game. It's a game that I like, and I fell off it for various reasons, but this seemed like the perfect opportunity to go back in there, finish the game. I get swept up in hype quite easily, and God of War Ragnarok has had the most hype, you know, of this year, apart from maybe Elden Ring. So I have bought that game and I have downloaded it, and I've been a very good gamer. I have not opened it, I've not started it. I decided to not only finish God of War and see credits, but have gone back in again and finished off a lot of side quests, picked up a lot of lore, have been listening to some interviews with the director of the game from the time when that came out. It had a very big release. It was a smash hit. It's one of the most critically acclaimed games ever. And so I'm going to talk about God of War today. And I know that I always say at the start of this podcast that it's a podcast about games from the artistic and creative side of the tracks. I do also say from indie to AAA. And there is a lot of wonderful stuff to talk about in this AAA blockbuster game. The art is amazing. The music is great. The writing is good too. It has an interesting relationship with Norse mythology, which is of particular interest to me as someone that lives in Iceland, at one of the cradles of that mythology. So I'm looking forward to talking about God of War today. I've got a lot of notes here, and it's going to be a fairly big deep dive into that game. Quite a thorough review, I think. I'm not going to talk through every single story beat, but I am going to go through the first opening third of the game, I would say, and talk about all of the gameplay, the combat, the story, have a little spoiler break, talk about the end game, talk about some of the gods that you meet in that game. So if you haven't played the game yet, you can still listen to this podcast. There'll be a big old spoiler warning when it's time for you to bow out. But before I get to talking about God of War, I will, as is traditional, talk a little bit about the games that have come out recently, the games that I've been playing, the games that I've been adding to the podcast slate for the future. And there are some really interesting ones, actually. I think I'm going to start by talking about a game that came out on Game Pass last week, the long-in-development Ghost Song. I mentioned this one last week. It's a very beautiful, hand-drawn Metroidvania-style game set in a sci-fi world, with a lot of nods to, I would say, Hollow Knight, a little bit of Soulsy influence, although not as pervasive and damaging as it has been in other games. I've talked at length on this show about how I think Dark Souls influence can ruin a perfectly good game. It doesn't in Ghost Song. Other people in the Discord have been talking about this game and playing this game at the same time that I have, and there has definitely been some talk of troublesome difficulty spikes, and I have run into a few of those, but I would say that the Souls influence is quite light in this game. There is a leveling system with many attributes that can be leveled up numerically as you gather resources on your way around this world. And there are a few other nods to Dark Souls. For example, at the start of the game, you wake up outside of your ship, your crashed ship, and you are a dead suit. This is a sealed astronaut suit, and you are whatever is inside, and you don't know yourself what you are. You don't know if there is an organic being inside of that suit, or if you are the suit, if you're a robot of some kind, or an AI consciousness of some kind. There is a little bit of intrigue around this as you move through the game, with different people that you meet interpreting what you are in different ways. But this is actually a pretty dreamy and pretty appealing Metroidvania. The visual style is really spectacular. It's hand-drawn and hand-painted. The environments are absolutely gorgeous. There is this 2.5D backdrop, even though you're playing basically 2D gameplay, side-scrolling. in the Castlevania Super Metroid style, like the Ori games, so you'll be walking past scenery that has depth to it, and many, many layers. It's not like simple parallax to illustrate depth. There's a fully 3D background that you're running past, even if you can't run into, and it looks gorgeous. The lighting is amazing. There are beautiful particle effects everywhere you go. The colour scheme is incredibly rich, even though it's a very bleak planet that you're on. A trick that these games often seem to employ is if you're running through a desolate underworld, exploring and unlocking new abilities, getting to high ledges and previously unavailable areas in the classic Metroidvania style, they often employ nature to bring a bit of life to it. So beautiful flowers, overgrown structures, broken places that seem to be a part of a civilization that has gone. All of that is very present in Ghost Song, and it really works. The music is also beautiful. It's almost like a very light, down-tempo, Sigur-Rós-y style. Not the big, bold, like orchestral Sigur-Rós, but the post-rocky parts and the instrumental parts and the quieter parts. It's an absolutely beautiful soundtrack, and that really matters in a game like this. So it looks gorgeous, and it sounds gorgeous. And the gameplay starts off pretty tough in a way that reminds me of Hollow Knight. The first area is very unforgiving. You die a lot, and at first you're like, can I do this? I'm not sure. But as I played for the first 2-3 hours, I picked up more health tanks so I could recharge my health. I found a melee weapon, I found a gun upgrade, and suddenly I was able to go much deeper in my runs and stop dying and being returned to the first save point, which is a Metroid-style statue, even sitting in that same pose. That's become like a piece of language for this genre now, that statue that's sitting down on the ground holding something up. In this game, it seems to be like the last, the corpses of a dead race, kind of. It's all very affecting. The voice acting is really good. Your character has this quiet, soft, female voice. And when it meets people, it reminds me a little bit of Solar Ash, which has beautiful voices coming through a phased effect, like you're hearing it through machinery. And the dialogue is great too. Like, your character is just sad and curious about this world, doesn't know what it is, seems to have a sense of right and wrong, seems to have some sense of wanting to help people. And so I found the whole package to be pretty compelling. And I played past the first few bosses, including a handful that I met early doors and felt like I would never be able to beat. And I was just like, okay, I'll explore for a little bit. And if I have to stop, I stop. But after you power up a little bit and explore and your health and your stats go up, those bosses become pretty attainable. It has that classic evasion gameplay, so it's most important to figure out the patterns of a boss and then not get hit. And then once you're not getting hit pretty reliably, you can just choose safe moments to shoot them, to melee them, and just dodge and dodge and dodge, and then hit and hit and hit. You also can buy something a few hours in that lets you see enemy health bars. Like, that doesn't happen at first, so you really don't know if you're halfway down a boss's health bar or just chipping away pointlessly at first. So there is this instinct to beat them, but you actually just can't. But you can run past them sometimes. And that's another Dark Souls thing. Like, if you can't beat the enemy, then go back or dodge past it and come back later. So I was really enjoying Ghost Song, and I think it's a really interesting, intriguing game. I did hit a boss that was just a bit too hard, even though I am fairly leveled up now. It was a boss that is fighting with a large weapon that fills half the screen. So there's very few safe spots. It's also on muddy ground, which means that you can't run around very reliably. You have to be in the air all the time. You really do have to relearn the whole game for this boss. And after 5, 6, 7 attempts, I ended up just closing the game. And then one night after work, I was like, shall I play Ghost Song? And it just made me feel tired to imagine going back and chipping at that boss again. I did go back in and just explore the map. The map has that familiar line-drawn look. And if there is a break in a line, there is a door you can get through. So I went and cleaned up the map a little bit, found some new areas, and found out there were lots of weapons and interesting power-ups hiding in plain sight. So I cleared the map. And I will come back to Ghost Song, and I will go back and try and finish it, but I did hit a wall with it. I get the feeling that a lot of people will hit that wall, and will have already hit it before the point in the game where I am, which I think is about halfway through the game. Sounds like it's 9 or 10 hours. But that's Ghost Song. I hope to come back to it, and if I do, I will do a full review of it later. I'm also adding a few items to the podcast slate. So I got a couple of interesting codes this week. One is for The Entropy Center, a game that I've been eyeing curiously for quite a while. It's finally out. It is a first-person puzzle game in the tradition of things like Portal. And in this one, you control time. So there are time-based puzzles in this game. It's a very intriguing-looking one. I have it downloaded on my PS5, and I'll be playing that one over the next few weeks. I also got a code for Somerville. This is a game that is coming to Game Pass next week. It is by one half of Playdead Studios, who made Limbo and Inside. And it's similar in nature. It's cinematic. It has a nice floating camera that looks like you're walking through a film. It has low poly graphics, and it takes place during an alien invasion. And as one of the last survivors in a broken world that is being overrun by a mysterious force, you have to get from A to B through obstacles, past searching spotlights and that sort of thing. There are some pretty basic puzzles in it. I hit a wall with a puzzle in that one in my first playthrough, and I had to ask the PR for help. They obliged me. I was just missing something pretty basic. I'm hoping that that's not a recurring theme. I haven't, straight off the bat, fallen into lockstep with the gameplay design in this game. I will say that. But hopefully that doesn't continue. I will be coming back to Somerville. It is under embargo, so I can't review it now. But you'll hear me talking more about that one in the future. I also bought a couple of games on my wish list. One of them is Owlboy, a 2D platformer that is a pixel art and very highly thought of. A lot of people have recommended Owlboy to me. I will occasionally on Twitter do threads and say, what do you think are the indie games that were underappreciated? Owlboy comes up a lot. Like, a lot of people really love that game. And it was on sale for £8 on the Switch store, so I bought that one. I haven't played it yet. And the other one I bought on a whim, it was on sale. It was on my wish list. It's a game that was on Game Pass, but left. And I played a little bit of it and enjoyed it at the time. Always thought I would come back to it. Never did. It's a cyberpunk isometric shooter called The Ascent. And I really enjoyed my time with this one. I had some vague plans to play it in multiplayer with my friend Kieran, who is a sometime guest on the show. But we never quite got around to playing The Ascent. And so by the time it left Game Pass, I just missed the boat on it, basically. But I really enjoyed what I played. It has these brilliant cyberpunk environments. So I'm adding The Ascent back to my playlist, and I'll be playing that one again on PS5, a PS5 version. So I imagine it can only look even better than I remember it on my big 4K screen that my PS5 is attached to. So that's all the things I've been playing and the things that I've added to the list. And before we get to God of War, let me just mention briefly, this is a patron-supported show. We have a Patreon Discord where supporters of the show meet and talk on a daily basis, just share what we're all playing, share screenshots, sale tips. There are 8 bonus episodes that you can listen to there about all kinds of things, games, music, travel, off-topic podcasts. I'm going to be making another one of those soon. I'm planning a music episode to round out the year. If you would like to join the Patreon and show support for this podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. I really appreciate every single patron that I have. I appreciate the generosity and the gesture of support. If you don't want to join the Patreon, you can also drop a star rating on Spotify or drop a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts. I appreciate all of that. So patreon.com/gamingintheWild, if you'd like to become a patron. Thanks very much to all my existing patrons, and thanks to you if that's something you would consider. And with all of that said, let's move on and talk about this epic game that I played this week, God of War. So God of War, it's a 2018 game. It could be safely said to be the 2018 Game of the Year. A lot of games will release a Game of the Year edition. Sometimes you question whether they have the right to do that, really, given how the game went. In the case of God of War, it's unimpeachably up there. People talked about that game in glowing terms. It won so many awards, so many Games of the Year. It swept the board completely. It was developed by Santa Monica Studios. It was published by Sony and is maybe the most Sony first-party game of all. It was directed by Corey Barlog. He seems like a pretty charismatic dude, actually. I've been watching some interviews with him from the time of the game's release. He's an interesting guy and a great figurehead for this game. The music is by a guy called Bear McCreary. It's really nice soundtrack, actually. It's a beautiful score. That piece that we were just listening to, interestingly, uses the choir Schola Cantorum. And this is the church choir of Hallgrímskirkja. This is a church about 50 meters from my house. If I were to look out of the window right now, I would see it. It's the White Church at the heart of Reykjavik. So that was really interesting to have that Icelandic tie-in on the music. This one did very well critically. It's a Metacritic 94. It's a Metacritic must play. How Long to Beat has this at 20 hours for the story, 31 for everything. I hit credits at about 23 hours, and then I played on to about 27 hours, and I have one side quest left to go, which I'm going to try and finish off tonight so that I can dig into Ragnarok this weekend and start that game. I've been keeping my powder dry until I felt 100% finished with God of War. Often when I record a podcast about a game, that is, for me, is the finish line of my time with the game. So I'm trying to complete games before I talked about them on the podcast now, because I have a tendency to skip on to the next game after I've done an episode. And the way that they describe this game is his vengeance against the gods of Olympus years behind him. Kratos now lives as a man in the realm of the Norse gods and monsters. It is in this harsh, unforgiving world that he must fight to survive and teach his son to do the same. And my take on this one is that God of War is an affecting father-son story set in a mythic Viking world of epic scope and scale. It mixes spectacle fighter bosses with exploration, dungeons, puzzles, and RPG progression. The gameplay can feel scripted and railsy, but overall, it's a god-tier game. And I would say that Sony is very good at large-scale, single-player, cinematic epics with a slightly adult themes to them that maybe would have more in common with what we would consider to be film writing with strong characters and strong stories. It's the Last of Us is of this world, the Horizons of this world. There's some of the top games that are made, and whether or not you are a Sony person, I think that we can all recognize that Sony's Interactive Entertainment Studios are making some of the most ambitious games around and have been for quite a while. No one else can really do what they do. And so this is one of those games. It's one of the crown jewels of gaming, really. I didn't play it for a long time because of the big muscle guy on the cover and the name and the booming Viking stuff. I was like, nah, right now I'm into Aloy, I'm into Jesse Faden. I'm not so into the superhero vibe anymore. And I don't really want to be a big muscle-bound guy smashing my way through the world. And so I perhaps unfairly didn't play this one for quite a long time and only played it this year for the first time. But I'm really glad that I came back to it. There is more to it than that. But there is critique to be leveled at Sony's model of AAA games as well. And I will come to those in this review. So it's not going to be an unreservedly positive review. It's going to be a fair review. And it's going to have a lot of praise in it. But it's going to be quite level as well. And I think at the start, it's probably good to talk about spoiler policy. This will be lightly spoilery at the beginning. For example, you will come across various characters, gods and beasts in the first third of the game. It could be considered reveals, I guess, but I don't think that if it were me, I don't think I would be upset to know their names, for example. I'm definitely not going to spoil any plot twists, any major developments, any late game bosses or outcomes until after the spoiler break. But I do want to mention that I will be naming characters. And if you really do want a truly spoiler-free podcast, this isn't that. But the level of spoilers that I'm planning to talk about in this opening section, I consider to be pretty low. But I thought it's only fair to you as the listener to flag that up. So this game begins with Kratos, a fictional demigod woven into Greek mythology, the star of the God of War trilogy and spin-off games that has been around for a long time, since the turn of the millennium. In terms of me having played God of War games, I tried out original God of War. I tried out original God of War 3. I played a little bit of them. I got the flavor. I beat some huge bosses, did some bruising combat, did a little bit of climbing and puzzling, and then thought, I don't know, this isn't quite hitting with me. These games feel a little old at this point. I've missed the boat. I don't have the nostalgia. I don't have the rose-tinted glasses. So I'm playing like pretty good, very old games right now, and I fell off them and moved on. But God of War 2018 is a completely different thing. It's a reimagining of this series of games in a new setting with new gameplay, with a new Kratos. And so while Kratos does carry all of the baggage, and it is on the timeline, it is on the God of War canon, it continues the Kratos story, it's a completely new spin on the game, and we meet a different Kratos here. So the traditional God of War is this rage-filled, unstoppable, battering ram of a man who has just been bashing his way through the Norse, the Greek pantheon, massacring the gods on a massive revenge quest that filled out the first three games. We meet Kratos years later. He is now getting on a little bit. He's not exactly an old man, but he's definitely past the prime of his life, you could say. He is a bit more grounded. We meet him living in a small cabin in the woodlands of a Norse region. It doesn't specify which region it is, but it has mountains that look to me like Norway. It has glaciers that look to me like Iceland. And so I guess when it comes to visual material, they probably pulled from the most dramatic Nordic landscapes they could find and mashed them together into whatever this place is. It's Midgard, so it's the fantastical realm of humanity where the gods rule over it from Asgard, Ausgard, I guess, the realm of the gods. And Kratos has been living quietly. He settled down. He got married and had a child. And we meet him at the very start of the game in this iconic opening section when he has his hand on a tree and he is sort of sadly considering this tree in the woodlands. It has a handprint on it in paint, and he starts to chop down the tree. There is a prompt on the screen to hit R1, and we get our first feeling of the physical, crunching, weighty feel of this game. Which is something that I'm going to come back to. And Kratos swings the axe, he chops down a tree, and we discover he takes this tree on a boat back to his cabin with his young son. They put it on a pyre, and it is the pyre for his wife, who has recently died. And so the game begins with a funeral, with a Nordic funeral. We witness the strained relationship between father and son. Atreus is young. He looks like, I don't know how old he is, like I'm very bad at this, 11 or 12, something like that. He's a kid. I don't think he's yet a teenager. So he's pretty small. He's got his voice hasn't broken. He seems to be a little sickly. He seems to be a little more emotional than Kratos, like a normal kid in some ways. Kratos is not a normal guy. He is emotionally sealed off. He has a booming voice. He refers to Atreus as boy throughout the whole game, and that's a little bit iconic too. Boy. He'll say it constantly throughout the game. Like if Atreus is like, hey, look at that, he'll be like, boy. Expresses disapproval. He's an authoritarian father who doesn't know how to be a father, doesn't know how to talk to his son. And we learn all of that very quickly in this opening sequence. So it's safe to say that very much like The Last of Us, in fact, this is a sad dad game. It's another entry into the sad dad genre. We have a sad dad who can't talk to his son, We have a child who is trying to find meaning, trying to have a relationship with someone who doesn't seem quite capable of it. And that dynamic is interesting. And that dynamic is a lot like The Last of Us, is probably modeled directly on The Last of Us, in which Ellie is trying to unwrap Joel's sealed heart in a way, just by talking to him, and her innocence and childlike spirit starts to melt those barriers just a little. And we see a lot of that in God of War 2. It's an effective formula, and it's put to great use here. And after the cremation, they discuss the mother's last wishes. She wants Kratos and Atreus to scatter her ashes from the highest mountain in the Nine Realms. Atreus is like, let's do it, let's go, I'll get my bag. Kratos is like, nope, you're sick, you're not ready, boy, you're not ready. And so they have a little to and fro. Atreus has a bit of a tantrum. It's right after the funeral. It's moments after the pyre has gone up in flames. And so Kratos says, okay, let's test you. Let's go on the hunt. And so with the ashes still smoldering from the pyre, which has just finished burning in the background, they go to hunt in the woods. And this is, I guess, how this game handles the tutorial. And it's pretty fantastic tutorial, actually. Like, it tells you everything very concisely. I felt like I had learned everything I needed to know to get through this game. But it was also the first time that I really paused to look around. You know, at the moment when you are set free in a game, the intro sequence is powerful, cinematic, great music, great close-up shots of the faces of our protagonists. But when you start to walk through the woods, I just took a moment here to look around, and I think that this game is one of the best-looking games I've ever played. Even though it's 2018, I was playing it on a PS5, so it's checkerboard 4K, mostly 4K, with 60 frames a second, smooth, beautiful, crisp, and detailed. So this is the best way to play God of War, for sure. It feels like, if you had told me that this was a PS5 launch title, I would have believed it in a second. This game has not aged. It's amazing. In the same way that Horizon Zero Dawn has done very well across time. And the faces still stand up now, even though the sequel has much better faces. Like, God of War is right there. This is at the pinnacle of how good games can look. And I love a really good depiction of nature in a game, especially in a 3D game where you can walk around, explore, go down pathways, just pause and move the camera, look up, walk up to plants and look at the detail, and just zoom in, use photo mode to zoom in on textures. And this game is just stunning. The woods that you walk through have fog like lying over the ground. There is running, burbling water all around you, coming from the mountains around you, through the rocks and down into the mud, which is shining below your feet with moisture. There are plants and flowers all around you, and the closer that you get to them, the detail just doesn't seem to give up. Like, you can get so, so close and never see a texture. Like, the textures are so good that you just never see the pixels. It looks like a flower. There are birds in the trees. There are butterflies around you. You can hear them. You can hear the air. You can hear the wind, the water, the rustling plants. The texture on the rocks is just beautiful, the way the light hits everything. The way that all of these assets have been designed into the environment is gorgeous. There are fallen logs everywhere. It's rich in detail. There are fallen trees that are at strange angles, having fallen into other trees halfway down. The trees kind of stick out at strange angles. They look very, very naturalistic. There are flurries of leaves that just whirl past you. Colors pop. Like, the Iceland is pretty featureless in many ways, but if you do actually walk through the highlands, even the highlands in summer, and look at the ground, you will see that there are tiny pink orchids, little flowers, little splashes of color. You can find little valleys even in the middle of the highland desert that are filled with pink flowers. And so there is like a nature surviving despite the elements feel to Icelandic nature. And I recognized that in this game, just in the way that the nature is drawn. The whole thing is just wonderful. The clouds, the mountains, the sound, it's unbelievable. And you quickly notice the famous one-shot camera as well. This game famously doesn't cut ever. So as soon as you start the game and the camera is on that tree and on Kratos' face and you chop down that tree, it's one shot throughout the entire game. And it has a photographer's eye. So the design of that single shot isn't like a traditional game camera in some ways. It does follow you. It's third person and it does follow you as you walk through the game. But it's very cinematic. And we often use the word cinematic to describe a game, but I think that this game is more cinematic and in a deeper way than most of the times that we describe a game as cinematic. And it feels like you're watching the work of a cinematographer following Kratos through this world. When you run, the camera will zoom in very slightly on Kratos, and then when you stop, it will pull out a little bit again, which has a very propulsive feel to it. It's like the camera, it's like the director is directing your shot throughout the game. It's almost like there's a director in a director's chair sitting behind you. It's the small movements and the way it all works is really, really something that I haven't seen before. It also has amazing depth of field in a way that I haven't really seen. Like, games do use depth of field, but in this, it just works so well. The mountains in the distance will be out of focus, and the things that are up close will be very crisp. And as you pan around and look at things, that will change, almost like you're looking through a DSLR camera. There is just something very filmic about the feel of the camera in this game and the way that that is done. And right from the off, it's noticeable. You get a feeling of quality. And it's kind of hard to put your finger on at first, but it's something in the way I've described how nature looks, the way I've described how the sound works, and the feel of the camera. You get a feeling that you are playing something a little different to other things that you've played before. And I felt like that right from the beginning. There is also a majestic sense of scale in this game. The highest mountain in Midgard, for example, looms over the play area for the whole time that you're in this game. You can see it from almost anywhere, and that's the mountain that you will be climbing. And it looks so huge. It looks like I've stood next to the biggest mountains in Iceland, the biggest glacier in Europe, and I've looked up at it. It definitely fills you with awe, and that sense of scale has been even magnified in this game in a way that feels very real. It doesn't feel fantastical, but it does feel larger than life. They've managed to make this game feel larger than life. And that happens again and again in the game. Like the lake at the center of the game that you'll spend a lot of time traversing, the castles that you will see, and as you get closer to them, they will just grow and grow until you're standing at the gate. And as you look up, you will just get chills because the world feels so big in this game. It's really something. There are creatures that are bigger than, you know, any imagining. It's a game that feels big. And that really helps with the Norse mythology, which is also happening on a grand scale. And with Kratos' physicality, there is a physicality to this game. But I will come back to that anyway. The whole thing looks like a fantasy painting come to life. I would say that the body motion capture is startling as well. Some of the people that you will meet on your journey, such as the Witch of the Woods, who you meet fairly early on, the way that she moves, I was mesmerized by. There are scenes in which she's offended or worried, and the way that she clenches her fists when she walks, and you can see the tension in her shoulders and the way she's holding her arms, her purposeful stride, and the way that she turns, the way that she looks at you, the glare that she might give you, is amazing. There was one scene that I took a video of and I just sat and watched it three times because Freya's physical personality was intense. Wonderful body motion capture here. Nothing that ever feels like a clumsy digital approximation of a human figure. Even on the enemies, you just get a feel that everything was motion captured perfectly. Really well done. The faces hold up too, I would say. Kratos' face is amazing. He has a huge, dramatic, hooked nose. He has a scowl. You can see the muscles in his face when he scowls, his brow furrowing. You can see the fine lines on his skin, which is powdered white. with Ash, you can see his matter-of-fact gaze, his predator's eyes, like the eyes of a snake looking at the world around him, like he could destroy and might destroy anything or anyone. He is an incredible creation. His deep booming voice is amazing. The voice acting is wonderful throughout as well. So that whole part of this package is already at a very high level. There are very few games that have reached this kind of quality generally. I would say only the Horizon games are really there. Horizon Zero Dawn's landscape is like this one, a bit more rich, a bit more soft, a bit more populated because it's a truly open world game, and God of War isn't a true open world game despite having a few open zones that you can explore. Forbidden West moved the goalposts again. The facial capture in that game is on another level to anything else, but as I said, this game feels like it could have come out now. But I thought it was worth at the start of the review just shouting out the intensity and beauty and startling detail of this natural world that the game is set in, this ruined world, this lyrical world. You feel the nature around you. The plants look wet. You can feel the dew on them. They look dewy. They don't look like video game assets. They look like plants. And I think that that went a long way to winning me over right from the off in God of War. So we move into the woods and we go on the hunt with Kratos and Atreus. And this is where the game teaches you some of the combat mechanics of the game, the combat basics. And these we've seen before. There are light and heavy attacks on the right-hand shoulder buttons. There is a block and parry on L1. If you hold it, you will block with your shield. If you press it at just the right time, you will parry and open up your enemy to attack. There is a dodge button, but it's not much of a dodge. Kratos is too big and heavy for a dash, for example, but he does a little shimmy. It's more like the evasion of a heavyweight boxer than a light-on-their-feet assassin, if you know what I mean. And it's also where we're introduced to Kratos' weapon. And his weapon is probably one of the best I've encountered in video games. It is the Leviathan Axe. This is a mythic axe with a curved handle. It's not incredibly impressive or huge like the, you know, the Dark Souls greatsword. But the special thing about it is that it's enchanted. You can throw it by holding down L2 to target and then one of the R buttons to actually chuck it. So you can target and throw. It will stick into enemies, or no, I think it actually passes through enemies. So it can hit many enemies in a row, I think. But the interesting thing about it is that once you have thrown it and it has spun away into the distance, spinning, hit something, you hit triangle to recall the axe and it will spin back to you through the air like a boomerang, hit things again on its way back to you, and then land in your hand with this amazingly satisfying thunk. So you recall the axe and it thunks back into your hand, you throw it again. It's imbued with the power of frost, so it sometimes freezes enemies, and if they are frozen, you can smash them. If you have thrown the axe and are under attack, you can also fight with your fists, so you have unarmed attacks as well. You can just pummel enemies. And that combination of throwing the Leviathan axe, recalling it, using it in melee combat, using it as a ranged weapon, is really compelling, and it's so fun to use the axe that that just makes all of the combat fun. Like, the weapon is incredible. I love the way it looks too. Like, when you throw it, it will glance off things. Like, if you don't aim quite right, it will spark, bounce off them. And you can see it bouncing off them. If it bounces off a cliff and goes out into a void, you will see it falling out of sight. And then if you hit triangle, you will hear it whirring. And it will slowly wear back and thunk into your hand. Like, you can't lose the axe. It's incredible. It's so fun to use. You also use it in puzzles. You use it to break things open. You use it to hack down pieces of wood. You use it to throw into switches that spin and make environmental changes and so forth. So the Leviathan axe is just super, super cool. later on, Kratos will get like another piece of kit, which I won't talk about until after the spoiler break. But really, this is the one. The Leviathan axe is amazing. You can change the pommel on the axe for status effects. You can change a couple of charms in the handle, which you can plug in and plug out to increase the frost or to increase various attributes of attack. There is also a rage meter in the game. So as you're attacking and landing hits and killing things, the rage meter will increase. When it is maxed out, you can hit L3 and R3, that is punching in the two sticks on the controller. Kratos will explode with rage, literally, and then he will run around and just be able to just massacre everything with his bare fists, which is pretty satisfying and can be a game changer in difficult fights. And the first enemies that we encounter are Draugr, and this is Icelandic for ghosts. But they are these crunchy old zombies that just lurch towards you. They're like ghouls. And sometimes in this game, they use Icelandic words. They use Old Norse throughout the game. And the Icelandic language is basically Old Norse. Like, it's one of the most unchanged languages, I guess, because of the insular, far-flung nature of this country, the culturally insular nature of this country, and the small population, the language never evolved that much. And so I have played this with Icelandic people with me, and they laughed. They found it really fun to see Icelandic language in the game. But something that was very funny to me in this game is that while they have used Icelandic words, authentic Old Norse, the pronunciation of Kratos and Atreus and the characters in the game is wrong. It's said in an American accent. So, for example, they will say, "Oh no, it's a Draugr," which is just really funny to the ear if you live in Iceland, because Draugr is the Icelandic way of saying it. And they will say, "Hey, let's use the Bifrost." But if you live here in Iceland, you will know that it's Bifrost. And one of the first bosses that you encounter is the Dovi Kaupmaður. Icelandic is tricky even for my tongue, having lived here a decade. And they call it the Dauði Kaupmaður. And it's Dauði Kaupmaður. So it's funny to hear the Old Norse spoken incorrectly in the game throughout. But the enemies are really cool. They have great motion capture. They're always interesting. Enemy variety is maybe one of the weak points of this game, but combat itself is fantastic. It's crunchy. It's physical. It's super satisfying. It's often pretty tooth and nail. Like, on normal difficulty, it's pretty challenging. You do have to learn the parry. You have to move right. You have to be tactical and strategic. You have to really learn your abilities. And the game does a great job of that. There are also QTEs in combat. There are QTEs throughout the game. I don't hate them, as I do in some games. For example, if a wolf grabs your arm in combat, you mash circle to shake it off, that kind of thing. If an enemy is staggered, sometimes you will get a prompt to finish it. So there are finishes in this game, and these are amazing glory kill animations. There are different glory kill animations for various types of enemy. So the finishes are cool. For example, if a Draugr is attacking you, Kratos will throw it to the floor, will stand on its head and crunch its head, will spin it around and then just throw it out of the arena. You'll hurl its body into a cliff where it will just explode and die. If it is like a sort of fanged seal type creature that leaps out of the dirt, he will grab it by its tail and swing it like a giant fish and just bang it onto the floor until it's dead, then throw it away. These are pretty satisfying, and they do serve a strategic purpose as well, because if you are in one of these animations, you get iframes for the duration. So if you're in a mob situation, it can be a chance to regroup. There are mini-boss finishes as well. For example, with a giant troll, you can jump onto its back and swing its arms to whack the enemies around you before grotesquely kind of tearing its head off, pulling its heart out. The boss finishes are mind-blowingly violent and gory. You're pulling the beating hearts out of giant beasts. There's a lot of dismemberment, etc. So finishes are cool in the combat. You can also use Atreus in combat. So Atreus, your son, is running around the battlefield, and he can fire arrows. He has a bow, and you can tell him to fire an arrow. So whatever you're looking at, if you hit square, he will fire arrows at them. And that's useful both because it does a little bit of damage, but until you power him up, it is a little bit. But he will aggro them away from you, so they will turn and go towards Atreus, which allows you to regroup, to move around, to get into an advantageous position, hit them with the axe and have them come back at you again. If you're fighting a giant boss, this can really help. So I really like the combat. Enemy variety is sparse. You do fight wolves and those fanged seals. You fight these frosty zombies, reavers. You fight a handful of nasty elves of various types and the odd werewolf and stuff like that. Trolls for days in this game. Like, the first troll that you meet is very impressive. The Dauvi Kaupmather with his giant battering ram that he swings at you. It's an absolutely epic battle. He is so big. He's like the size of a house. And he can stamp, he can spin quickly and hit you with his battering ram. And this feels epic. So at the end of this hunt in the intro, the end of the tutorial, you fight the Dauvi Kaupmather. And, well, I'm struggling to say Dauvi Kaupmather as well. No wonder they couldn't say it in the voice acting. But he is a really cool first boss, and he does give you a taste of how crunching and brutal and big the combat feels in this game. It is quite an epic feeling encounter. And after that, Atreus has trouble in the fight. You're not expecting to fight this troll. It's like a random encounter at the end of the hunt. When it dies, Atreus kind of freaks out a little bit. He's like releasing his grief, and he starts slashing the body. And of course, Kratos says, "Boy, you are not ready." And Atreus does not agree, and it's like, "We just took down this troll. Surely you can see that I'm ready." And they go back to the house. That's the end of the tutorial. It's the end of the opening part of the game. It's a pretty epic opening. Feels really good. You do move through a little bit of dungeon in that time as well. You open some chests. You get a basic feel for the gameplay. And then the game has something of a turn. And you fight the first real boss of the game. So that huge troll that you just fought, which feels so big, turns out it's a mini boss, and you really don't know what is coming until it hits you. So this part of the game is, I guess, what the God of War series is most known for. It's spectacular, incredibly interesting, massive, over-the-top, cinematic boss fights. A stranger comes to the door the next morning. A tattooed guy, heavily tattooed Viking wanderer. Kratos tells Atreus to hide in the basement, and then addresses this stranger. He knows this is not going to go well. And I guess this is, we're still in the intro of the game here. We're within the first, I would say, 2 hours of the game. And this is the introduction of a pretty major character who is going to be following us throughout the game. So the Wanderer turns out to be none other than one of the Norse gods of the pantheon. It's Balder. He is invulnerable in combat. And he screams at you throughout your entire battle with him. He screams in this really strange way, "I can't feel anything. You can't hurt me." And it's so weird. It's such a weird thing to be like breaking this guy into a cliffside and have the entire mountain fall down, to have him break the ground open and to fight him as you fall into the chasm, to climb out of the chasm and be fighting him during the climb. When you get out, you bury him under a huge piece of rock, like the tip of a mountain, smash it into Balder, and he will and limp away. And Kratos is having a hard time with this fight. You will limp away, and then the mountain lifts, and Balder is still there, and he comes at you again. And my jaw dropped during this boss fight. Never quite played anything like it, to be honest. This is something really special about God of War 2. These boss fights, there is nothing like them, I think, in terms of the scale, in terms of the feeling of scale. Nothing is safe. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if the planet broke and you fell into the core of the Earth and fought in the lava. Like, that kind of stuff is not off the table in these God of War games. So the Balder fight is your first real taste of that kind of battle. It does have moments of combat where you are in a clearing and Balder will do this darting run towards you. So he's hard to hit with the Leviathan axe. And you have to parry him or dodge him because he hits pretty hard. You can die a couple times in this fight. So it is good combat. There are lots of QTEs in it too, where you are hitting that finisher button to try and finish him, but he is unfinishable. And so it's a really interesting battle, and my heart was racing in this one. I was laughing and cackling as I was doing it because it's just so over the top and fun. And that was the first taste of that, really. Kratos eventually, I think, flings him away, something like that, into the distance or down a deep hole. He realizes that you guys are no longer safe in the house, that these gods know where you are, that they are coming back. And so Atreus gets his wish, and you pull together your things, and the two of you set out on the journey to go to the top of the highest mountain and to scatter the ashes of Kratos's wife and Atreus's mother. So that's the opening of the game. I would say that marks the start of the journey. And most of the game is this journey. It is the mission. You have your objective now. You know where you're headed. You have the character set up. You know that there are gods on your tail. Atreus is sick. And that is a theme throughout the game. You learn more about it as you progress through the game. It's a factor in the game. Kratos and Atreus' relationship evolves throughout the game in an interesting way. And from there on, you go out into the world. And this is linear sections. You will be running through forests. You'll be running through clearings. You will occasionally fight. You will occasionally go through a cave section where there are chests and puzzles, such as if you pull the chain that pulls up a drawbridge and then throw the Leviathan axe into the, I don't know what you call it, like the fulcrum of the door, it will freeze the door in place. You can let go of that chain. You can then move through that door and summon your axe back from the other side of the door. So the Leviathan axe is very useful in puzzles. There is lots of puzzles. There are chests that you have to open by, for example, ringing three bells within a certain time limit, and they will be spread around the area. So first you have to spot them, then you have to figure out a way to traverse quickly between the three of them enough to open the chest. There is another type of runic chest where you just have to find three runes in obscure spots within a location and smash them all. This is not fun. These are like Where's Wally style puzzles. They reminded me of the bad stuff about Hellblade, where you're looking for environmental details. I understand that it's a way to get you to look at the environment, but it's not fun just running around the same clearing, looking through every hole in the cliff and every branch in the trees to try and spot some dumb rune. So that got to me a little bit. But the moment-to-moment gameplay is pretty fun. Like, there's a lot of collecting that goes on. You can smash open these urns that you find everywhere, and you'll hear a clink of coins, and you'll get hack silver, which is one of the main currencies of the game. You'll move through villages. There are corpses everywhere. It's like a dead world in some ways, in a really interesting way. And the traversal is very fun. Kratos feels very heavy. If you see painted ledges or ledges with series of runes on them, then you can climb on them. This isn't very detailed climbing. You just push up if you want Kratos to go up. Occasionally you will have to hit a circle button to make him leap between ledges. Atreus jumps onto your back and you climb together. If the ledge is too high, you can push Atreus up onto it with a button prompt. He will then release a chain that you can climb up. Atreus will often stop and say, "Hey, what's that?" Or he will get distracted. And if you look where he is looking, you will often find something pretty fun. He will often ask questions and talk to you. There's like a Joel and Ellie vibe to the whole thing. The things that he is looking at, he will often see something hanging in a tree. If you look up overhead as you are moving through this game, you will see barrels that are suspended from branches with a little hinge on them. If you throw the axe and smash that hinge, the barrel will fall and break and you'll find treasure. So there's a lot to see in the environment and a lot to find as you are moving around. You'll find little things tucked away everywhere. It's actually very fun. It does remind me of Last of Us gameplay, except instead of finding bullets and so forth, you are finding money, you are finding armor pieces, you are finding charms that you can plug into the hilt of your axe. there are a lot of resources, although I glazed over and checked out almost immediately on this. Like, you will find soft Svartheim steel, hard Svartheim steel, embers, world dust, ember dust, world ember dust, world soft ember steel, whatever. There are so many of them that it's ridiculous. And when you go to a forge to increase your weaponry or charge up or power up your weaponry, you can just see if it has a green tick, you can do it. If it's red, then you can't. And so you never really have to think about these resources. It could have been simply, you know, silver, blessed silver, or whatever, world silver. And it would have been fine to have three, but they have, for some reason, decided to do this RPG thing where there is like 30 different resources that you can find with silly names, but it's not necessary for the gameplay, and I tuned out of it straight away. But the moment-to-moment is pretty great. I like running through these gauntlets. I like running through these traversal puzzles and so forth at the start of the game because it is so beautiful. And it certainly drags at some points in the game, but at the start, I was still in the honeymoon phase and really enjoyed it. And later on, after credits, I got back into the rhythm. I felt more in tune with doing this stuff for fun and went back and finished a whole bunch of side stuff that was really enjoyable. You know, the dungeons do have good puzzles in them sometimes. So the moment-to-moment is good. And as the game progresses, you meet some interesting characters. I would say the next ones that you meet are Freya. Freya is a fantastic character. She is a witch that lives in the woods. And you have a little hunt sequence again, where this time Atreus spots a boar. And it's an interesting looking boar. It has markings on it. And you do another little hunt, like the stag at the start, and he lands a blow on it. But then Freya appears, this woman, this witch of the woods, this earthy looking Viking woman with braids and tattoos. And she's sad. She's devastated that you've hit this boar. She said it's the last of its kind in all of the lands. And she decides to try and heal it. And there's a really interesting moment where she says, "Were you hungry? Do you need food?" And Atreus said, "No, it was for target practice." And you just feel like the biggest asshole, like Kratos and Atreus, this warrior and his young son, just confronted suddenly by the first feminine presence in the game. He was like, "What the fuck are you two doing? You lunatics, stop killing this rare creature. Why are you even doing this?" And just make you feel like a pair of idiots. And that's a really interesting moment that I really liked. I took to Freya immediately, perhaps because she is like a feminine presence in a super masculine game, which is something that I will come back to. But she cradles this boar, she decides to heal it, Kratos picks it up at Atreus's urging, and there is this amazing jaw-dropping moment, one of many, where Freya walks away from you, she crouches and picks up dust from the ground, and she throws it at this wall, this solid wall of entwined plants, and says, "Greiða," which is Icelandic for comb, and it kind of combs, her magic combs away this wall, and all of the vines untangle, and this red wood is revealed with autumnal look and falling leaves all around you and splashes of red leaves everywhere. It looks like a beautiful painting. So that's your introduction to Freya. She's quite an amazing character, and she sticks with you throughout the game. She lives in this house that looks like it's straight out of The Neverending Story or Labyrinth or something, underneath a giant turtle for some reason. A lot of this stuff is from Norse mythology. It's gleaned from and reinterpreted from Norse mythology. So it does have this rich seam of the vibrant imagination of those stories, of the Icelandic, Norwegian, the Nordic storytelling tradition, tall tales about big characters in amazing locations. And you do feel that in the game. I think that, and the sense of scale that I've talked about, really contributes to the vibe of this game. But soon after that, Freya lends you a boat and you arrive at the hub of the game. So about the structure of God of War, there is a big lake, the Lake of the Nine, at the middle of the map. And that's where you will go out from to do all of these little quests and bits all over the map. And so the game feels like it opens up here. And I'm going to have to hit the spoiler break soon because things after meeting Freya and starting to traverse realms and so forth feels like you're knee-deep in the story or waist-deep in the story at this point, and it's perhaps not fair to keep talking about that stuff. So I will say, just to round out this section, that like the rowing is fun in this game. There is like a fast travel mechanic that is good in this game. You'll find little gates that lets you just zip between locations. I guess you go into the roots of Yggdrasil, the world tree, and that's how it's explained in the mythology. And you do meet Sindri and Brokk, or Brokk, if you're pronouncing it as an "ur," these wonderful dwarf brothers that you meet throughout your adventure, who are blacksmiths and real characters. Sindri, I've described in my notes as a Caucasian germaphobe. He's like a flat-headed little dwarf with very clean armour, and he's constantly heaving at the thought of having to touch anything. It's just such an interesting character choice that I really appreciate. And his brother Brokk, who I've described here as a gruff, blue-skinned stoic. And they are estranged blacksmith brothers who you meet throughout the map. And one of the quest lines of this story is asking them why they fell out and figuring out that whole situation. They are really entertaining. They're really fun. You meet them all over the map in little tents. They just sort of zip around the map. I guess it's a little gamey that they're always wherever you go, but they always have a line about why they are there. That's where you enter the upgrade system of the game, upgrade the pommel of your axe, upgrade your various abilities, spend all your skill points and that sort of stuff, spend your money, sell resources. So Sindri and Brokk are really cool characters. Again, wonderful first-class motion capture, wonderful facial animation, wonderful voice acting. So I would say that Freya, Sindri, Brokk, and Balder, the four that I've talked about, these are really the four big characters of the game. And so it's quite a small cast if you think about it. I guess there is another character called Mimir, who is like a presence, let's say, that accompanies you around the map too with a broad Scottish accent. But I feel like he's passed waist deep in the story. So I'll talk about him after the spoiler break too. I guess, though, before I check through into that end game talk, I also want to talk about the fact that shortly after this part of the game and after Alfheim, like the beautiful elven realm that you will have to travel through in order to dispel that darkness and ascend the mountain, I had already started to check out a little bit when it comes to the gameplay of God of War. I was starting to feel a little fatigued, and I found myself just lying. You know when you're staring at the screen, going through the motions? I started to feel like that around this time in the game. And I've thought about why that might be, because as described, there is so much to love in God of War that I'm confused as to why I didn't like it quite as much as I perhaps felt that I should have, given the overall quality. And I've written it down, I've broken it down into a few downsides of this game, so I'll go through those before I head past the spoiler break. And I guess one of them is that there are lots of scripted events in this game. So, for example, you will lose control of Kratos regularly. Like, the camera sort of moves slightly differently, zooms in close onto the back of his head or whatever, and you realize that you're no longer controlling him. That happens a lot. You lose control of Kratos in regular cutscenes. I would also say scripted events count as squeezing through cracks. Like, you know, when you have to hit circle, squeeze through a crack, and then you just push forward for 10 seconds and watch the animation. The climbing feels pretty automated. It's almost like the interaction is so low. You're just pushing a direction and watching an animation. It doesn't feel at that moment like you are in control of Kratos. That's bad. And I think that the feeling of disconnection between having agency as a player in the moment-to-moment gameplay isn't always there. It's the same in the one-second animation of vaulting over things. Like, you hit circle, you watch an animation. And when you're watching an animation with no control, there's a fine line to be found there where the player still feels like they're in control and it still looks beautiful and you're still traversing. And I think in this game, there are just a few too many scripted events, scripted animations, set animations that you're just watching. So I start to feel like a spectator a little. And if you combine that with the linear nature of many of the dungeons, where you're going through a puzzle sequence, you just have to solve. You just have to find the runes to open those chests. You have to figure out how to use the axe to freeze open a door. There is very, very little room for player expression in this game. It's only really combat where you get to be creative, in inverted commas. So there is a feeling of being on rails that starts to creep in. I would say that in some games, every player's experience will be different, and there are emergent moments or creative moments where you feel like you've done something cool that you thought of. In this game, I don't think any of those emergent elements are there. The builds don't feel incredibly meaningfully different to me. Like, you can do lots of different builds with different elemental attacks and so forth, but they don't feel like they really change the core combat to me. They just make it look a bit different. And maybe they do change whether you're doing mostly melee or mostly ranged, but it's a small difference. I feel that every player in this game probably has a pretty similar gameplay experience, in a way that starts to feel limiting and in a way that let my attention start to wander. And I would say that it's fine for that to be the case. Like, it is cinematic. It is wildly ambitious. It is spectacular looking. The boss battles are intensely brilliant. The sound of music is first class, and so is the writing, the voice acting, the crunching combat feel. The game feel of the combat is awesome. But overall, the feeling of interacting with this game isn't great, I would say. And I'm surprised that that didn't come up in more reviews. Maybe that's something that other players feel more comfortable with and other critics. But to me, it made my eyes glaze over. And if you are playing through an hour of gameplay between story beats, between mainline story beats, like doing a little sub-quest, for example, The Light of Alfheimer, I wasn't engaged in that at all, despite the fact that it's a stunningly beautiful environment with light coming through these translucent leaves, and it feels golden and heavenly, and there's a war between the light and dark elves. I was just playing through all this stuff, just jumping over gaps, looking for the next ladder, looking for the next climbing point, holding forward for 10 seconds, going through a couple combat arenas. Hours of gameplay, like 1 hour plus, maybe 2 hours. I was checked out at that point. And we're not halfway through the game yet. There is a lot more of that. So I think that's a big problem in the game. I think for me, that knocks off a mark, maybe two, if I were reviewing it. I do still really rate the game, and I understand the critical praise. I understand the legendary status that it has, but it's not a perfect game at all. And I think that that comes down to gameplay choices, gameplay design, and how gameplay seems to be the bottom of the list of stuff that was worried about, or at least the kind of gameplay that I think really brings a game to life. So it does end up feeling a little stiff. I thought about this, what language to use to talk about this earlier. It was like if, you know, in real world events, if Kentucky Route Zero is stumbling into a bar in a foreign city on holiday and seeing a poetry reading and an amazing musician, an amazing local musician, and feeling like you are discovering and learning. And if Outer Wilds is like some highly rated movie that you'd never heard of that a friend recommended to you and that you end up doing some deep dive into and learning all about, then God of War is like a ride at Disneyland or the Mall of America or something. It's just so big and glossy and plasticky in some way. Even though it has that earthy feeling of Nordic mythology, and it does a great job at rewriting it, and there's so much to love about it, I would say that it does perhaps lack a touch of that special magic. And it is a subtle distinction, but it's something that occurred to me, and something that I wanted to talk out a little bit on the podcast. So if you are a God of War fan and feel outraged at what I'm saying, then I'm sorry. But maybe there are some others among you that that resonate with what I'm saying here. And I think that that's where I will leave this part. So next I will have a little talk through some of the spoilers of the game. Some of my favourite moments of the game I'm going to talk about. Just some sequences that really stuck with me. And the big twist at the end. So this is a significant spoiler break. If you haven't played God of War and plan to, then I would advise dipping out now. And if you want to stick around for this short section at the end of the podcast, then I'll be right back after this. So as I have said, I think that God of War is a game of amazing moments. And some of the ones that I wanted to touch on, I mean, the dragon fight as you are ascending the inside of the mountain is immense. Like, I've never felt that sense of being locked in battle with something bigger than understanding. It's like, it's so vast. How did they do this in God of War? How did they make it feel so big? They've just used the potential of a video game graphics to make this vast beast feel real. The way that it leaps from the ground onto a mountaintop that is in the distance and then leaps back again and is the size of a city block. It's just nuts. And the fact that you jump into its mouth, the fact that you can run up its tongue, that's how big it is. And it all feels so fluid and amazing. The sense of mythic scale reminds me of like the old stop motion movies like Jason and the Argonauts and things like that. It's on that scale. You don't really see that. You know, it's like maybe in films like Pacific Rim or something, you get a feeling of it, but it's done better in God of War than in movies. The huge battles. And also summoning the World Serpent was such a cool moment when you emerge onto the bridge and use that horn to summon the World Serpent and its scales and its scaly body wrap around the hills around the lake and are taller than any building that I've ever seen. It's like insanely huge, the World Serpent. It wraps around the world. The scales are vast. And the fact that that head comes and tries to speak to you in a deep tone that echoes across the lake in the way that it does. Unforgettable, dreamlike, mythic moment in this game. I also really enjoyed meeting Mimir. Mimir is tied to a tree, or he's been absorbed into a tree. He is held inside a tree. He cannot escape from it. It has wrapped around and grown around his body. And you need to take Mimir with you, and you're like, you can't get him out of the tree. But because he is like a mythic being in this mythic world, you agree to cut off his head and take it with you. And so you have this head dangling from Kratos's belt for most of the game. Maybe the belt isn't the right place to hang him. It's a bit gross. Mimir spends an awful lot of time dangling around Kratos's crutch, now that I think about it. But I love the fact that Kratos refers to him as head. What are you talking about, head? Throughout the whole game. It's so funny. And Mimir's stories are really cool. Like, as you are rowing, he will tell you these stories of the Pantheon and tales of old. And he seems to have been around for most of it. So Mimir is just an amazing presence in the game. I love that the stories that he told are staggered, so that if Atreus has just learned about something, he will sometimes ask Mimir about it later, and you will have Mimir expand upon the mythology that you have just discovered. And I guess you meet him at the first big twist of the game, which is that the tallest mountain in Midgard is not the tallest mountain in the Nine Realms. That's in Jotunheim, the sealed giant kingdom. And so you have to traverse all of the realms, finding the entry stone to Jotunheim. Eventually you get there, and then I guess we get the twist, the big twist of the game. Atreus' sickness is that he is part god because Kratos is his father, and he is part giant because Laufey, his mother, is a giant. And so we discover that Atreus isn't in his real name. We discover from some murals that the giants referred to him as Loki, and suddenly it dawns on you. Loki hasn't been mentioned once. You've heard so much about Zeus, so much about Thor and Magni and Modi, his sons, so much about Tyr, so much about Freya and Hel and all of these different beings, but we never heard about Loki. And so it turns out that they've rewritten the mythology so that Atreus is Loki. And they've even rewritten some of Loki's myths, for example, that Loki, that someone shot Balder with a mistletoe arrow is woven into the story. And that's a really cool twist, you know. It's just another step forward in this really good knack that God of War has at rewriting classic mythology to include this story. There were a couple of other scenes and moments that sprang out to me, like the corpse of the giant. I think he's called Thraumur or Thrialma or something like that, walking across the corpse of a giant with a huge head as big as like the Guggenheim in New York City is just nuts. Freeing the chained dragons were my favourite side quests. The tower defence section where you're on a floating ship, that was an interesting little twist on a combat scenario. I'm glad that they put it in there. I really enjoyed the evolution of the relationship. I really enjoyed Kratos's softening towards his son and his realization that the qualities that he loved in his wife are present in his son. And so there is this breaking point where he says, finally, you are very much like your mother, and actually calls him son. The sad dad thing isn't exactly my vibe. Like, I think for a lot of people, that was a part of God of War that really resonated with them. Perhaps because having an unemotional dad is really common or something. I never had that with my dad. He's like, you know, he's fine with speaking about such things. There's a little bit of that in him. He is like a Northern English man, but he's not closed off enough to really make me relate to this story. But from things that I've read, I feel that that is something that a lot of people go through and is perhaps why they relate to this sad dad story on such an emotional level. A lot of people feel that they see their own story here. I did not. Maybe that gives the game an extra level. And I will end by saying that the idea that the killing of Baldur and the enraging of Freya and the events that you've set in motion by killing Magni and Modi, the sons of Thor, are a brilliant setup for Ragnarok. Like, the war has come. The first snow of the Fimbled winter has fallen. And I guess that's where the game ends. And, you know, this is a great game. I've said it lots of times. I'm very impressed with it. Thank you for sticking around to the end. That's God of War. So I hope you enjoyed that review of God of War. Thanks for sticking around to the very end. I really enjoyed the game. It feels good to air out my feelings about that game, actually. There's something about having critique of a game that doesn't seem to have been addressed in the way that it is handled in the zeitgeist, handled in Metacritic, handled in the critical debate surrounding the game. It felt nice to air that out. I would love to hear what you think of God of War. Do you also think that the gameplay sections run too long? Do you also think that the sad dad stuff is a little tired at this point? Let me know. You can find me on Twitter at Gaming in the Wild. I love to hear from people that have heard the show, even if they disagree with me, or even especially if they've got feedback, if they have a different take on a game. So feel free to get in touch. Love to talk to people. If you would like to support this show and come and continue the conversation in Discord with all of the other listeners of the show, we have a special channel for God of War Ragnarok now, and a whole bunch of people are about to play it, so there's going to be a spirited debate in there. It's patreon.com/gamingindthewild if you would like to support this podcast. I recently upgraded all of my audio equipment using that Patreon money from the last year, so you're hearing me speak on a really nice Shure microphone now, held by a beautiful Bose mic stand, which means that for the last hour and 20 minutes of recording this podcast, I didn't have to sit hunched over a little wobbly tripod on my desk. I can sit comfortably with a straight back, and I think it sounds better too. So thank you to all my patrons. If you would like to join them, patreon.com/gamingindthewild. And I will be back with a God of War Ragnarok review at some point. Might take me a while to play it. I hear that it's 30 hours long, and after just playing God of War 2018, I don't imagine that I'm going to dive straight through it. But the reviews say that it's better. The reviews say the story is more interesting, and that the combat has been worked up and that the traversal is more interesting too. So who knows? I think I might start Ragnarok at this weekend, and that might be the game that I talk about next week. Or it might end up being Somerville. It might end up being Ghost Song. So lots of great games coming up on the podcast. Stick with me, subscribe, leave a star rating and review. Thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other. And bye-bye for now.
This holiday season, give the gift that everyone actually wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. From USDA-certified very tender filet mignons and perfectly aged ribeyes, to juicy burgers and gourmet sides and desserts that make every meal unforgettable, Omaha Steaks brings steakhouse-quality flavor straight to your doorstep. Whether you're gifting family across the country or filling your own freezer, every box arrives perfectly packaged and guaranteed to impress. Because nothing says I love you most like a gift of Omaha Steaks. Skip the malls and the guessing. Go to omahasteaks.com right now. That's omahasteaks.com to save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Hurry, this deal won't last. Omaha Steaks, delivering joy since 1917. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.